To begin our third argument on the calendar. This case is Little Earth of United Tribes Housing Corps versus Benita Little Ghost. And the case number is A210884. Council, can you both see the clock that is on the screen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. So that will be the clock that counts you down as you each give your arguments this morning. As you both know, the appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. I just ask that you identify yourself and the party before you begin the argument for the purpose of our record. And if you're both ready to go, it looks like you are, we can begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Sauer and I represent the appellant, Benita Little Ghost. This case prevents an eviction action, which as a matter of law should have been ended before it began. Should have ended because at the moment that the landlord accepted rent for January of 2020, they waived their right to evict Ms. Little Ghost for all of the allegations contained in the termination notice. This is a matter of law. It has been the law for nearly 115 years. Respondent is asking this court to overrule a clear Minnesota Supreme Court precedent in Kenny. McKinney was a case in which the tenant was found to have run an opium den in clear violation of their lease, as well as the law. And despite that fact, the court ruled that acceptance of rent with knowledge of a breach waives that breach without regard to the intent of the landlord as to waiver.
In this case, can I ask you about the Kenny? That obviously is a key case to your waiver argument, and I see you made that repeatedly at the various hearings, I believe, to the district court as well, or the referee, which was adopted by the district court. And I want to focus on Kenny. I'll agree as a general matter, what your point, I saw nothing that overruled Kenny. And so regardless of its age, it appears to be good law to the extent of what it says. And that's kind of what I want to ask you about. There's a particular provision I'll say too, I'm not yet fully convinced by your argument to contrast those subsequent cases, the Oak Glen and the Powell case and others, but perhaps that's a side point right now. My question on Kenny, in Kenny, and I don't know if I can recite the specific page, 256, I believe, the court was distinguishing the cases cited by appellant, I assume, or the losing party in that case, landlord, in its arguments. And one of those distinguished cases, it looks like the Doe versus Moe, but the statement is this: neither will the receipt of rent after the landlord has actually commenced his action of ejectment for forfeiture amount to a waiver. In other words, Kenny was distinguishing the facts of its case versus that line of even older cases. Isn't that precisely what we have, that exceptional scenario here? If I understand the facts correctly, on December 30th, the eviction matter was commenced, and on December 31st is the receipt of the money, which initially the referee wasn't sure what it was, but I think the district court later used the phrase rent, so let's assume it's rent. Wouldn't that be the exception, and therefore Kenny would not apply, and the subsequent cases that make it a fact issue be applicable for us to consider, and was appropriate for the referee and district court to consider?
I would say no, Your Honor. There was quite a number of cases that were distinguished or rejected, basically, by the Kenny court. But you know what they say is, you know, none of these cases are availing.
Can I just clarify, though, isn't it true, though, in our case, that exception that they were referring to is what we have here? The action was commenced and then the money was received. Factually,
the action was filed and then the money was received one day later. The action was commenced by service of process a few days after the payment was actually made. So I do think that there is a difference there. I wouldn't concede that that's what that Kenny says. It has to be received before the commencement.
Well, that's a good point that you raise, and maybe I missed that in the brief. So under housing court, is there any distinction to the commencement of an action and unlawful detainer from the rest of civil procedure, which outside of housing court would be the date of service?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So your point being the action indeed was commenced after receipt of the money?
Yes. And truly, you know, as soon as that money is accepted, again, that does constitute a waiver. You know, both the district court and the referee and the district court judge sort of engaged in these factual analyses as to the landlord's intent with respect to acceptance of rent, which is the exact type of analysis that Kenny rejected explicitly. So those analyses, you know, cannot be accurate under Kenny. As soon as rent was accepted on December 31st, the case is over and there's no basis to proceed with this eviction. I do think that it's important to place Kenny in context because there are a number of other cases involving waiver that are cited to in this case, both outside of the landlord-tenant context and within the landlord-tenant context. So Kenny specifically applies to landlord-tenant cases involving allegations of a breach of a lease. This is different than general waiver, which we certainly concede is an issue of fact. And also within the landlord-tenant context, there's waiver. There's basically three bases for evictions. There can be non-payment of rent allegations, and waiver of those claims is addressed by the statute, Minnesota Statute 504B.291. There's holdover claims, holding over after the end of a tenancy, and waiver of those claims is addressed by the Arcade case, which is from 1906, written by the same justice as Kenny, and explicitly distinguished by Justice Jaggard when he wrote Kenny, that these are two separate issues.
Ms. Hauer, how do we, our court in the Oak Glen case kind of repeated the phrases in some of those cases you're referencing as well, that Minnesota recognizes exceptions, and this is in the eviction scenario, basically the receipt of rent as waiver, which would be Kenny. How do we rectify that? And it's cited to the Powell case, and I believe one of the other ones you just referenced, I can't remember all of the names, as an ongoing, and all of them cited Kenny. So in other words, none of them ignored Kenny, but they all seem to make it pretty clear that depending on the facts of the scenario, if it's something different than Kenny, I'm assuming that therefore intent is one of the factors of the landlord. How would we disregard that? Or would we just have to say our own court got it wrong and the other courts that was citing all subsequent to Kenny all got it wrong?
It's not all of them, Your Honor. And I would say most of these cases cite the language in Kenny regarding the policy reasons for the rule, you know, and that pertains as to, you know, sense of repose. Basically, landlord can't hold a breach in their back pocket and then show up later with these claims. So they all cite to that, but those are policy reasons. Those are not elements of the defense. Moreover, the exception really comes up in MCDA versus Powell. And that is a case where they recognized landlords and tenants can contract around the general rule in Kenny. And that is specifically what happened in that case. There was a valid non-waiver clause in the lease in MCDA versus Powell. So that really is the exception. MCDA versus Powell then goes on in dicta, and it's clearly dicta. It doesn't really hold. They've already made their decision at that point to say, well, but citing back to the Arcade case, which again has nothing to do with breach of lease. It has to do with holding over after termination of a tenancy, and it's a different rule. So the MCDA versus Powell court mistakenly cited back to the Arcade case and said, but waiver is always an issue of fact.
Ms. Sauer, I'm curious about it. I was interested in that too. I saw that in your brief that you call it dicta. And I, wonder if you could elaborate on why it's dicta, that what the court did use, and we oftentimes will use a sort of language, but even if it had not been in the contract, and then it cited the same law that Oak Glen, which seems to me, while it might be dicta in the sense, if maybe this is what you mean, that they'd already resolved it, but their point that seems to be that the court was making is that under any scenario, the result would have been the same. Isn't that a little bit different than dicta? It's repeating what Oak Glen says, that our state has subsequent to Kenny recognized the exception to the standard waiver. With all of this, and that's why I started out with Kenny. Right now, I'm just suggesting to you what seems to me is Kenny has some very specific facts. And if you weren't consistent with those specific facts, then it might arguably be a done deal. But it seems like our facts are fairly unique here, where you've got not a landlord asking for rent, but notifying the tenant before the landlord receives the money as we'll assume it's rent, what it's not, and it's not a waiver. And that seems like a significant distinction from Kenny and again, some of those subsequent cases that dealt with waiver.
And I would really, Your Honor, recommend going back to read Oak Glen, because Oak Glen actually applies the rule in Kenny. It doesn't actually create any kind of distinction from Kenny. So, there is some language there, but Oak Glen doesn't do anything. And quite frankly, these are all Court of Appeals cases, none of which indicate an intent to overrule the Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. So they could not have really been overruling Kenny.
Could one way to look at that, and I appreciate that, and certainly at least I can speak for the panel or myself, I would not be tending to do that either. But my question is, wouldn't that, when you see all those cases consistently saying the same thing, at least suggest to us the way Kenny is to be interpreted based on the facts of Kenny? And if you have the facts of Kenny, therefore, then that's a done deal. Meaning, if you have no, obviously the contract isn't what we have here either. The district court clarified that, but we do have language, and we don't have a landlord going after a tenant after giving notice of termination and seeking rent. Aren't those pretty critical fact differences from Kenny?
No, Your Honor. This case really truly is Kenny. And the only case, that actually distinguishes Kenny substantively is the MCDA versus Powell case. And that case was a contract case. That contract case focused on the non-waiver clause that was in a lease, and it found that to not be invalid as an adhesion contract, as an unconscionable adhesion contract, right? So that only applies where there is a contract, where there's actually an agreement. We don't have that here in this case. There is no non-waiver clause in this lease. I don't know why there is no non-waiver clause in this lease. The landlord did put in a non-waiver clause as it pertains to non-payment of rent and acceptance of partial payment of rent in their lease. I don't know why they didn't do it as to breach, but they didn't. And because they didn't, there is no contractual agreement that acceptance of rent does not waive, that has contracted around the rule in Kenny.
Ms. Sauer, I was just going to say, this may feel like the longest 15 minutes of your life. It was brought to my attention that the clock actually malfunctioned. And so you have about 3 minutes less than you thought. In fairness, I'll give it to you. But I did want to interrupt to let you know, if it feels like this is going on forever, it's not your fault.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did notice it.
I like to think that the age of the Kenny decision caused everything to suspend here as we were talking about it.
Yes. So, but again, the MCDA versus Powell case focuses on a contractual agreement. And again, is dicta language. It does not turn on this case because of that contractual language in MCDA versus Powell, but that dicta language cites back to Arcade, which is, again, not the case that the court should have been looking at. They should have been looking at Kenny if they were looking at waiver of a breach of a lease. So to take that language from Arcade, and again, to say, you know, Kenny is an old case. I don't disagree. It's been the law for nearly 115 years at this point, right? Arcade is even older. It's almost 116 years old at this point. So, I think that the way it's applied in this case cannot be construed, that this case truly is Kenny. It truly is the same facts as Kenny. There is no agreement. There is no consideration for a contract between landlord and tenant for the landlord not to have waived their claims. And they did so. I also want to point out that there is this other case. So if MCDA versus Powell represents the exception to the rule in Kenny, then Pollard, Southdale Gardens of Edina versus Pollard represents the exception to the exception of the rule cited in Kenny, and which I think is very important to distinguish from just being a rule that pertains to waiver. In that case, in the Pollard case, there was a non-waiver clause in the lease. And yet the court found that it was possible for the landlord to have waived the non-waiver clause. So again, that is not applicable here because again, there is no non-waiver clause and there is no agreement before landlord and tenant. It is unreasonable to allow a landlord to file an eviction, immediately waive that eviction, and then proceed based on new and frankly changing allegations raised after the fact. They can't have their cake and eat it too. Once they waive their entire case, they do need to start over at the beginning with a notice that meets the requirements of both state and federal law. In other words, there has to be one final noticed breach that has happened after a waiver, including for those types of ongoing breaches, as referenced in Oakland. There has to be a notice. There has to be a final breach post waiver, and there has to be a notice, and the landlord needs to start over and go from there. Okay. These notice requirements are clear, and they are constitutionally required due process, protecting a tenant's property interests in their home. And these are the most vulnerable tenants anywhere. This is housing that is intended for individuals who need to be able to have this type of supported housing in order to pay their rent, as referenced in the Thorpe versus Housing Authority of the City of Durham case, which is United States Supreme Court from 1969, which is 1 year before the also landmark Goldberg versus Kelly case, which happened in 1970, but they're very similar principles, is that there has to be due process, there has to be clear notice, and there has to be, in this case of the federal regulations, the 10-day notice and opportunity to meet with the landlord before an eviction case can begin. Allowing these shifting allegations or additional allegations also runs contrary to the state law and the state rules in 504B.321 and Minnesota Rules of General Practice 604, which specifically require a landlord to state the facts which authorize recovery of the premises. So to do so, again, once they've waived all of those facts in the initial filing, they come later on. They need to start the process over again before raising new questions.
So may I just ask, we might be out of time, but so the way the waiver works under Kenny, in your view, is that if the landlord accepts the payment, right? It's just accepting the payment. So should the landlord must forego all rent while the breach action is going forward? Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the holding of Kenny.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and can recover that rent later or no? Just has to forego rent for the whatever period of time permanently, or how does that work?
Yes, no, there's nothing that says that it can't be recovered later. However, Kenny clearly states it's either accept the rent or move forward with an eviction, and would point out that, you know, eviction actions they happen extremely quickly. The plaintiff landlord is in the driver's seat. and they get to design this. They can get into court if it's just a regular eviction in 10 to 14 days from when they file. That's required by the statute. And if in this case, it would be a little bit longer because of the federal subsidy. So you'd have to tack 10 days onto that. Nonetheless, it is under a month either way that the landlord can get into court. And assuming that they come and come prepared with all of their evidence, then it's a very quick and frankly brutal process. Even absent that, I guess I'll skip over my arguments about trespass. But truly, I'm asking this court to reverse the decision of the trial court and dismiss this case as a matter of law. To do otherwise would overrule the Minnesota Supreme Court precedent in Kenny, and it would do substantial harm to important due process requirements in eviction cases, both federal and state.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Sauer. We'll now turn to Mr. Kalla. And Mr. Kalla, before you begin your argument, we did end up giving Ms. Sauer about 3 extra minutes. If you need 3 extra minutes, no pressure. Feel free to take it just in the interest of fairness. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Kalla. I represent the respondent, Little Earth of United Tribes Housing Corporation, the plaintiff in the eviction case. Little Earth is the landlord. The appellant is Ms. Little Ghost. She is the tenant. She's actually still in possession of the property. Notwithstanding Ms. Sauer's accurate characterization that evictions can be quite rapid in the instance, this case has been going on for nearly 2 years, and she's still in possession of the property. I'm going to start off talking about the Kenny proposition off the top here. The check that's at issue is a $190 money order that was tendered to the landlord. And as Judge Slater points out, after the commencement of the action, and maybe I'll back up a little bit here. I believe the commencement of the action is when the case is filed with the court. Similar to a mechanics lien action, the commencement is the filing.
And where do we, Mr. Kalla, I was going to ask you that because that's what Ms. Sauer indicated too. And obviously that's contrary to the general civil rules that it's upon service. Where would you point us to confirm that in housing court commencement is at a filing?
Because I can't serve anything that hasn't already been filed where the court hasn't already issued a summons.
So the rules require the filing and then the service.
Yes, most civil cases in Minnesota State Court are commenced by the service of the summons and the complaint, documents the plaintiff typically drafts themselves. There are some exceptions in Minnesota, mechanics liens, 5-week reduction actions for mortgage foreclosure cases, and evictions. Those are the 3 I'm most familiar with because I've done those. But you file the case and then you serve. I can't serve anything prior to filing it because I don't have a summons. I don't generate, as the plaintiff, I don't generate the summons. The court does that. And I take the summons and the complaint that I filed after the court has provided the summons back to me with the court date. That's what gets served on the tenant. Now, the court obtains personal jurisdiction over the tenant upon service, but the case is actually commenced when it's filed. So and here we have-
Why does that matter? If Kenny is about, well, it's waived, it gives a tenant the feeling of repose because the understanding is that's forgiven the past breaches if they're paying for future rent there. Why, if they don't know about it at commencement, why isn't it service then that's relevant?
So 2 things. One, to address Judge Slater's point about the one case that talks about payments made after the action is commenced. That would be one issue. The second is there's two ships passing in the night kind of deal here. And we've got the commencement of the action. Perhaps the tenant's not aware of that. In this case, they should be aware of that because Exhibit 2 and Exhibit 3 were the pre-eviction termination notices to the tenant alerting her that she's going to have an eviction filed on her. She knows it's coming. Most cases don't require pre-suit notice to a tenant. Most market rate properties for non-payment of rent, there's not a requirement that the landlord notify the tenant before the action is filed. Here there is, and that notice was properly given. So the problem we have here is that the landlord anticipating a situation where the tenant's going to pay the rent, tender it, and then claim waiver, we explicitly drafted the language in Exhibit 3, the December 26, 2019 notice that was appended to the complaint. And it says clearly, acceptance of payment after this lease termination will not waive the lease termination or the violation or the right to litigate the allegations in the eviction complaint. It couldn't.
Tom, so why is this different from Kenny? I mean, Kenny, there was notice, right? And then the landlord accepted payment after that.
I'm not sure if there was notice in Kenny. I don't think there was explicit notice to the tenant that if you pay the rent, you are agreeing that you can't later on raise a waiver defense for acceptance of rent.
Oh, is that what you think the notice has to be? I thought it was notice that the contract is being canceled and you're going to be evicted. But you're talking about that there needs to be, that Kenny is about whether there's notice regarding waiver?
No. The notice of the landlord today, the Little Earth case, provided two notices. One on December 18th, that's Exhibit 2, and an amended notice of termination on December 26th, that's Exhibit 3. Both of those notices were appended to the complaint. Here, as the attorney for the landlord, we included additional language to address the complication that arises when tenants pay rent when we're trying to do a breach eviction case.
Oh, no, I understand that. So the waiver part, what you said about waiver in the later, I'm just wondering if we look at Kenny, on April 25th, the plaintiff served notice on the defendants, they should vacate by the end of May, that the lease is canceled, et cetera. And then on May 3rd, the plaintiff went and collected rent. And then the court decided that was a waiver. So in other words, even if you tell the tenant, you're going to be out of here if you accept rent, there's a waiver. And I'm just wondering, you talked about, well, this tenant knew this was going to happen, but so did the tenant and Kenny, right?
Well, the notice that you've described in the Kenny case is more akin to a termination, like a non-renewal notice. I mean, I'm required by law, by federal law, to give the notice that we gave Exhibits 2 and 3 to the tenant. And there's nothing, I mean, if the notice in Kenny would have said, hey, by the way, you know, if you pay rent after your vacate date and you hold over and we hold on to that rent, you agree that you can't raise the waiver defense. That's the difference between our case today and the Kenny case. Is here, there was explicit, express, clear notice to Ms. Little Ghost that her attempt to try to pay the rent, and I'm going to call it a gotcha litigation tactic because that's what it really is in reality and in practice. The landlord gets this money, and what are they supposed to do with it? Well, here, they held it, they didn't cash it. I don't know in Kenny if he cashed it or not, but here the landlord did not cash it. And Ms. Sauer actually brought a motion in March 5th, 2021, alerting the court that, hey, we cashed this check after the eviction was ruled on. Here's the problem the landlord encounters. They get the check while the eviction's going on. They hold the check uncashed. Tenants argue, you accepted the check, you haven't returned it. Okay, we try to return the check. We mail it back to them. They say we never got it in the mail. Now we have a check that's missing, okay? We hold on to the check, tell the tenant, hey, come and pick the check up. We don't want it because of this waiver issue. It's your money, come and get it. They don't come and get it, or they claim they never got the notice to tell them to come and get it. This is the problem the landlord has. So what do we do?
If you think that you can cash it because you preserved your right to waive by letter, why don't you cash it? I don't understand that. Why are you trying to return it? It seems like you think you have the right to keep it.
I do think we have the right to keep it. I do think the landlord has the right to cash it. But to avoid another argument from defense counsel that, hey, you cashed this check, right? We're saying we didn't cash the check. If Ms. Sauer's client would have come to us and say, hey, that $190 money order we gave you on December 31st, we want that back. We would have given it back. There was never a request for that money to be returned.
Mr. Keller, can I don't recall seeing in the record or in any finding, any factual findings of all of what you're just describing to us. Is where would we look? I guess what I'm getting at is if what you're now arguing, I didn't see in the brief that we didn't actually accept it in the traditional sense. We attempted in multiple ways to return it. We didn't cash it. I just don't see any of that. I just presume that it was cash. You received it. And the argument was the notice you gave on the, I think the 26th, that it does not constitute waiver.
So there is no evidence in the record that it was cashed. In fact, the motion brought by Ms. Sauer, I believe in early March, indicates that the landlord cashed the check after the eviction action was completed. What I was talking about by the notice of the tenant, by, hey, come pick up your check, what I'm explaining to the court is that's the rationale for why we drafted the Exhibit 3 language the way we did. To avoid,
can I just clarify, problem, though, then, Mr. Colley, you would agree, I assume, that the notice itself is not the exception of consideration, because that would have to be in a lease, which the amended order clarified there was no lease language, correct?
I would agree that the language is of the anti-waiver does not appear in a lease. I would disagree that there's no consideration for the language in Exhibit 3. I mean, Ms. Sauer points out in her reply brief that the tenant has an obligation to pay the rent. And if she doesn't pay the rent, she's going to be looking at an eviction for breach and an amended eviction for non-payment of rent. The problem with that argument is it runs afoul of 504B.285 subdivision 5, which is what we call the combination case statute. And it talks about when you combine allegations of breach and non-payment, the process the court goes through is they litigate the breach case first. And during the pendency of that breach litigation, the tenant is not required to post the rent that the landlord alleges is unpaid. If this was a standard non-payment of rent case and the defendant had a defense for why they didn't pay the rent, such as a habitability defense, the court would typically, under the Fritz doctrine, require the tenant to post that admittedly unpaid rent with the court and then litigate the non-payment issues. When you combine breach with non-payment, that structure is changed drastically. We litigate the breach. If the landlord wins, the case is over. If the landlord loses, at that point then, even then, the tenant isn't required to post the rent. That's 504B 285 sub 5C. If the landlord does not prevail in proving material violation of the lease, and the landlord has also alleged that rent is due, the tenant shall be permitted to present defenses to the court that the rent is not owing. The tenant shall be given up to 7 days of additional time to pay any rent determined by the court to be due. There's no prejudice to Ms. Little Ghost by holding back that rent. Yeah, we can file and amend the case to add for non-payment, but it's not going to change anything. I mean, what does she gain by paying the rent that's due? Nothing, except avoiding another eviction. But even the second eviction where she doesn't have to pay the rent until we litigate the breach case first. The point is, Exhibit 3, that language at the end, is designed to avoid the precise problem we have here, and that is the tenant paid the rent, they argue waiver. Now, in this case, there's no dispute about the factual findings of the breaches of the lease that Ms. Little Ghost and her sons committed at the property. There are procedural defenses here, waiver, irrelevancy, amendment, those types of claims, but nothing goes to the heart of the landlord's case that there was a fundamental breach of lease here. What is the landlord supposed to do? Deposit the rent with court? We can do that. There was never a request for that. Return the rent to the tenant? There was never a request for that. The landlord gave notice to the tenant that if she pays the rent, she is agreeing that she can't raise the waiver defense later on.
I guess one suggestion of what the landlord could do is have it in the lease. I think that's what the argument is, that that waiver, non-waiver, anti-waiver provision needs to be in the lease. Can you speak to that? Why a letter is sufficient?
What public policy is advanced by that? I mean, the Oakland case talks about the public policy of repose, okay? I mean, there's no prejudice shown to Ms. Little Ghost. She didn't rely upon paying that rent and thinking, oh, I'm out of the dark on this one. The eviction is over. There was no testimony about any of that. There's no testimony that once she got the notice to vacate, she went and lined up another property, okay? And then because she paid the January rent, she didn't have the deposit to put down that second property, and so she lost it. I mean, those are the types of repose prejudice scenarios that would support a waiver defense, even in light of anti-waiver language. But there's none of that. I mean, Ms. Sauer talks about repose is not an element of waiver. Fine. But it's the public policy behind why we have the waiver clause. I mean, what is the difference here if we have the waiver, anti-waiver clause in the lease or in the Exhibit 3 notice that preceded the filing of the eviction complaint? The same public policy is achieved. The tenant is put on notice that payment does not constitute a waiver of the landlord's right to proceed with the eviction for breach of lease. That's what we're trying to do, is give the tenant that notice. Could we have put it in the lease? Surely. Is it going to go in the lease next time? Yes. Is it a failure to the point where this case must be dismissed? No. There's no public policy that would, I mean, what's the public policy behind Kenny to say you can't do this?
Just to clarify, Mr. Kala, again, the bottom line, though, is it is true that the Powell case referenced, and I think O'Glenn, two exceptions to the Kenny rule. One is if it's in the lease, so we rule that out here. The other is if the landlord manifests an intent not to waive. I assume it's that category by which you are arguing factually the referee made a correct ruling that that notice, though not in the lease, factually indicated an intent for the landlord not to waive. Is that an accurate summary of both the law and the facts as applied here?
Absolutely, as to the landlord's intent. And I think the law on waiver is that the waiver has to be knowingly made and intentionally made. Here, clearly, neither of those are shown, especially when we understand that the rent wasn't cashed until later on. I mean, if the tenant wants the money back during the pendency of the eviction, I tell my clients, give it back to them, right? But don't just send it back to them because it gets lost in the mail.
That's Mr. Kala, can I follow up? And I want to do that with the general principle that Kenny outlined. The general principle is certain that money tendered by the tenant and received by the landlord as rent is paid as rent and operates to bar the landlord from asserting against the tenant past causes of forfeiture under the terms of the lease, which were known to him at the time of such payment. Ms. Sauer makes the point that therefore there is no factual analysis and all the cases after that got it wrong. Your client undisputedly received the money. It's been termed as rent by the district court. So give us your best argument why that Kenny doesn't directly apply and resolve the matter.
So if Kenny, quoting, is a general principle, why isn't Kenny say it's an absolute principle, unimpeachable by any fact pattern? Why isn't that what Kenny says? I mean, when Kenny says it's the general principle, that begs the question, what are the exceptions to that? Well, how about a situation where the landlord tells the tenant in advance of the filing, you pay, it's not a waiver. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. None of the cases that the tenant cites address that fact pattern. We're trying to demonstrate the landlord's not intending to waive. The landlord doesn't know there's a waiver because of this language. This is language, you know, drafted by the attorneys. I drafted it to put the tenant on notice. If she wants the money back, we're going to give it to her. There's nothing to be advanced by imposing upon the landlord a forfeiture of their right to evict simply because the tenant gave rent to the landlord at a point in time when she knew that that rent could be accepted by the landlord and wouldn't allow her to raise the waiver defense. There's nothing in the record investigating Ms. Little Ghost's understanding of the impact of the receipt of Exhibit 3, the December 26th notice. Nothing. This is purely gotcha litigation. Tenants give the money and they get out of the rent. The idea that in Kenny that you should have to forego payment of rent during a litigation. I mean, this case has been going on almost 2 years. A landlord should have to wait 2 years to get their money? That's absurd. It's just absurd. The one last thing I'm going to use with my overtime, if I may, I just like to point.
You've already used up your overtime. You started with 18. So if you could just wrap up.
Real briefly, I just want to point the court to page 17 of my brief referring to the HUD occupancy handbook regarding the inclusion of allegations that arise after the filing of the eviction complaint. That addresses the amendment issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. And now we will return to Ms. Sauer for a 5-minute rebuttal, if you'd like to give one.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. A few things that I would like to clarify. First of all, Ms. Little Ghost has been paying her rent. It's been paid into court as part of the appeal bond, which is required by Minnesota Statute 504B.371. That is irrelevant here as to whether or not that money is there for that landlord. Second of all, Mr. Kahlo makes a factually inaccurate statement that I want to correct. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that the January rent payment that was made on December 31st, 2019 was not cashed. There's also absolutely no evidence that the landlord made any kind of attempt to return it to Ms. Little Ghost, including at the four different trial dates that occurred in this case. What Mr. Kahlo is referring to is a motion that I filed, and this is an extraordinary case, Your Honor, because it has spanned the COVID-19 pandemic, basically it was put on hold for a full year. But the motion that we filed was about rent payment that was accepted, taken by the landlord to pay for rent for February of 2020. And the landlord did hang on to that, and they waited until the day that the district court referee issued a judgment before they cashed it. However, that was the payment that Mr. Kahlo is referencing in this case. And I would notice that payment was made after all of the facts in this case that were raised in this case. So completely separate issues.
Ms. Sauer, can I ask you a question? We haven't talked about it. We may, depending on the issue of waiver, need to get to it, but on the trespass, I agree with you in your brief that Hoyt decision, although it's criminal, it was kind of interesting, seemed to be a bit of a overview of landlord-tenant law, and they were quite broad, and I think that's part of what the dissent in that case was criticizing the majority for, but it is say what it says. Here's my question for you. It struck me as a bit odd that landlords cannot, in the common areas or in the outside property, if people are acting disorderly or perhaps criminally, or the allegations here is some urinating and breaking of locks, can't trespass someone from those areas, even if they cannot trespass someone from the individual unit. Is that your understanding of the law? So in any, the whole physical surroundings of a rental property that the landlord has no authority to prohibit someone from going there, which they would necessarily have to do to get to a unit. And if that's the case, is the only place for that to be done would be in a lease agreement, some language that tells the tenant that we can do that. And we will, if they commit acts outside of it that violates our terms.
No, Your Honor. So what that language in Hoyt says is not that the landlord has no control over any of their, you know, the common areas. Rather, it says that the landlord can't use their control over the common areas to prevent ingress and egress to the tenant's property. So,
but how do you not? I mean, would I be missing it? They would have to ingress and egress over the prohibited area to get to the home, and would not that be at least circumstantial evidence, especially here with video where they got keys to get into the home, that tenant is aiding their violation of a trespass order. Otherwise, they have no way of enforcing it, or as little way, it would seem.
I think I would argue that it has to be used for ingress and egress. And if someone were to, say, be hanging out in the hallways and causing trouble, again, none of which was proven in this case, There was absolutely no evidence to support that presented. But if that were happening, then at that point, the common areas are not being used for ingress or egress. They're being used for another purpose, which is not authorized. And that would be a significant distinction. I really want to reiterate that that the respondent, that the landlord here, is truly asking this court to overrule Kenny, and the notice is not good enough. And I would like to analogize to Minnesota Statute 504B.291, which does address waiver in the non-payment of rent context that was put into the statute in the 1990s. So with assumed knowledge of both Kenny and Arcade and all of the other case law, and as well as Powell, and is consistent with that, and says that landlord and tenant may agree only in writing. There has to be an agreement in writing. And in this case, there is no agreement in writing. There's no consideration for an agreement in writing. And that is the simple fact. The landlord does, under Kenny, must either refuse to accept the rent or waive their right to proceed with the eviction case. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.